Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never. And we're still going through Madison's notes. Actually, there's a lot of really important information, and more importantly, insights to the perspectives of these men. One of the things that we're going to kind of recognize is the fact that there were certain men that wanted to make sure. It's kind of the chicken egg. Actually, that's not a good metaphor. They talk about, and as a matter of fact, we'll get to it, where I think it's Mason talks about the necessity of people selecting their representatives instead of the state legislatures. And Mason's charge is that it's the only way that the people can protect their rights. However, the fact is, I mean, when we look today, it's the people just surrendering their rights left and right for the, you know, I'll just say the scoundrel that is willing to give them, better security so that they can control them better, you know, like Obamacare. We didn't gain any rights when government gives us things. We lose them. And so I think maybe at the time the paradigm was one way, but I think the framers also knew the dangers of democracy, and because the Teitler cycle is that cycle that a democracy is established, and it takes about 200 years for it to evolve from the point where the people are electing people to protect their rights, and eventually enough people start realizing that is, you know, if they can get their government to take from those who have to give to those who have not, then they can what that entails is that people are living on the teat of government, and that as soon as they realize that they can get almost anything out of that teat, then they constantly vote for more and more of those people willing to do that. Now, mankind has never come out of the closet in such evil ways. There's never been a point in time where the concept of being able to kill a person to take their organs to give to somebody else would even be acceptable. I can't imagine. I do understand that there were some pretty dark paradigms, and there probably were some pretty evil people. But the way we're living today with, well, I might be wrong here. Because of our technology and our advances, we've been able to go as evil as we have. Maybe that's really more of an accurate depiction of why we have these problems. But what we're going to go through probably today and tomorrow, probably for the rest of the week, is some glimpses, because we're still talking about I'm still reading through, because we don't have Paul, Mishipal, but we're still reading through the reactions to the Hamilton plan. Now, Hamilton made a really good argument that they needed to have this stronger government and so forth. And you know, he was basically appealing to those who had an affinity towards a king. Now, why did people in America hate the king? Because, bottom line, they loved the English government. And they loved living under a king for so long. As a matter of fact, when you distill everything, when you take our history and you distill it all down, King George could have stopped the revolution on a dime had he just granted the colonies representation in Parliament. It would have been that easy, because that's what they were clamoring for. And let me take a quick wander into some space, because I know there's a lot of people out there that create this, I'll just say they're enamored with, or they create this affinity for the Sons of Liberty. Those acts where people were defiant and civil disobedience. And they look at that and go, that was the true American Revolution, when actually it wasn't. I'm here to tell you, folks, that our framers were very civil-minded. As a matter of fact, they believed and they held to the line that they needed to petition, you know, the king, they needed to petition Parliament for the redress of grievances. This was the inalienable right. And so when I come out with the First Amendment right of petition, my next article, I'm going to lay out this clarity that the right of petition was such an integral part of life in the colonies for up to the Revolution point. Somehow we lost we lost this right in our own minds, in our mind's eye, because today, and actually I honestly believe that this was a part of the progressive scheme in getting us to cling to methodologies like protests and rallies and taking it out into the street as if, you know, that radical form of anarchy, that radical form of revolution was something that was a part of our heritage, when it's not. The right of petition and a civil discourse is truly our heritage. And I see these, you know, I'll say memes, I see these comments of people that are glorifying, and it really lends to the media and I think just the standard paradigm of a carnal state or a carnal society. If it leads, if it bleeds, it leads, you know, and sex sells. In other words, the appeal of history has been more towards the lusts of, you know, the thoughts and desires of the reader. Tell us about the, you know, these fights. As a matter of fact, when you look at the individual recipient of history, you're going to find that they want to use an equalizer. An equalizer is where you can go in and change the specific frequencies of the sound that you're receiving so that it is tailored to precisely how you would like to hear it. And that's nice. I know lots of people that do that. But when you do that, you've literally changed the sound and tone of a piano. It doesn't sound like a piano anymore. It sounds like a mutated artificial device that kind of resembles maybe a piano, but it's not a piano. And in ways, I think most people don't like reality. When they receive history, why is it? Because when you're with the opposite sex, you know, when you're with a woman, why is it that the women want to see history in the context of their gender, their sex? Oh, you know, I want to hear about the women, or, you know, blacks or Hispanics, or why is it that we only want to hear about ourselves and nice stories that make us feel good about ourselves? This goes back to this whole history, the rewriting of history, the fact that we have monuments and the fact that monuments are being taken down. Anybody that is familiar with our forefathers, our framers, these men who stood up at the time it needed to be done and they did their job. They didn't feel they were any better or any different. And as a matter of fact, they did not want statues. They did not want their likeness on money. They didn't want, as a matter of fact, they were the antithesis of trying to become gods. They didn't want people because they knew what would happen. They understood that when we start building statues, these men become idols. And if you look throughout, you know, all of society, how godless is that? When we really, as a matter of fact, you know, there's actually a commandment that talks about thou shalt not have any other graven image or what have you, right? I mean, we shouldn't be worshiping these men. And now we're at a point where we're actually arguing and fighting whether we take them down or not. I honestly think that the truth is what's the most important thing. And I get it that sometimes you can put a statue up, but the statue itself becomes just the same thing as a graven, you know, it's an image. Let's actually, you know, fix real big problems before we worry too much about the rewriting of history, because I'm not convinced that the history you have, I'm not convinced that the history we have is based at all on the facts. When I look and when I read, as a matter of fact, I was involved in, you know, in this discussion where people were talking about the Sons of Liberty and so forth. And I pointed out that, because they were making these assertions in this dialogue, they were making assertions that the Sons of the Boston Tea Party and these other acts of, you know, violence, the civil disobedience, was the true resistance, the beginning of the true resistance. And I said, absolutely not. It was the petitions. The first thing, as soon as they started passing these laws, they were submitting petitions for the redress of grievances. The brawlers, those people who didn't care about their rights, they were just wanting to protest. They just wanted to, you know, throw the tea into the sink. I mean, think about it, folks. Our forefathers, the men that actually made the decision that we were going to declare independence, wasn't done as an act of defiance. It was done as an act, a cognitive act of survival of liberty, because they realized it had become very clear that at this point in time in the British Empire, the colonies were basically the same as slaves as those slaves that were being kept in the colonies. And this is why this huge paradigm shift, you know, awakened this beast called liberty in America and gave us a radical turn in enlightenment, where the world tilted on its axis. This is not hyperbole. After the Declaration of Independence, the true effort of eradicating slavery throughout the world had been ignited. It took over a century. Actually, it took about a century and a half to go throughout the world. But I can tell you that if you look at the history of the states that fought slavery after our Civil War, the two predominant states was Britain and America. In stopping the slave trade and going in and shutting it down, we pretty much got close to eradicating slavery throughout the world. Now, to be honest with you, most people would complain, what a bunch of do-gooders. I mean, come on, these people want to have slavery. I don't know anybody that wants to be slaves. And as a matter of fact, the way they did it, it was wrong. It was one thing to basically go in and say, hey, we believe you guys should have a self-governing system. Had we actually acted like missionaries of the Constitution, had we actually acted like ambassadors of liberty, and came in and said, look, we're not going to get involved in all of this, you know, this caste system and everything else. But we're here to say, if you want to enjoy, if every person in your nation wants to enjoy liberty, then come let us know. But anyway, I'm sorry, this monologue went way too long. Bottom line, as we start looking at what these men are going to be talking about, the sovereigns, we're going to be talking about, we're going to get to the point of the electors. At this point, we haven't even really shown the light on this thing called the choosing of the president. that one topic was probably the most debated topic throughout the Constitutional Convention, because this was an invention. This was absolutely an insight in how to frame a republic where you could actually have a president selected without the people or a popular vote or without anything like that, without a true direct democracy, but still allowing the people to choose their president. Now, again, emphasis on the people, but we're going to get into the electors. What we're going to do today and tomorrow is kind of go through this post-dialogue that we've been going through, because they're clearly setting the stage of, you know, how to move forward as they really take the Virginia plan and they start building upon it and actually shaving it back and moving it back, because we're going to get into this concept of a national government and more of a confederation. And this is why, when it was all said and done, they really looked at the United States as a confederation more than a federation. So anyway, we're starting off with Mr. King, who basically wished everything depended on this one proposition, that no objects might be improperly indulged against the phraseology of it. He conceived that the import of the terms states, sovereignty, national, federal, had been often used. And we kind of covered this last time, but I want to kind of take it from here and build on this. And had often been used and applied in the discussions inaccurately and delusively. The states were not sovereigns in the sense of contended for by some. They did not possess the peculiar features of sovereignty. They could not make war, nor peace, nor alliance, nor treaties. Considering them political beings, they were dumb, for they could not speak for any foreign sovereign, whatever. They were deaf, for they could not hear any proposition from such sovereign. They had not even the organs or the faculties of defense or offense, for they could not themselves raise troops or equip vessels for war. On the other hand, if the union of the states comprises the idea of a confederation, it comprises that also of consolidation. A union of the states is a union of the men composing them, from whence a national character results to the whole Congress, or to the whole. Congress can't alone, without the states, they can't act, and their acts will be binding against the instructions of the states. If they declare war, war is de jure declared, captures made in pursuance of it, or are lawful. No acts of the states can vary the situation or prevent the judicial consequences. If the states therefore retained some portion of their sovereignty, they had certainly divested themselves of essential portions of it. If they formed a confederacy, in some respects, they formed a nation in others. The convention could clearly deliberate on and propose any alterations that Congress could have done under ye federal articles, and could not Congress propose by virtue of the last article a change in the article whatever? And as well that relating to the equality of suffrage as any other, he made these remarks to obviate or to remove some scruples which had been expressed. He doubted much of the practicability of annihilating the states, but thought that much power ought to be taken from them. Mr. Martin, said he, considered that the separation from Great Britain placed the 13 states in a state of nature towards each other, that they would have remained in this state still till this time, but the confederation that they entered into the confederation on the footing of equality, that they met now to amend it on the same footing, and that he could accede to a plan that would induce, or he would never accede to a plan that would introduce an inequality and lay 10 states at the mercy of Virginia, Massachusetts, and Pennsylvania. So okay, so one of the things we garner is that they looked at those three states as probably the most mighty states there was. And interestingly enough, New York had a great amount of potential. Why did he exclude New York? So the other point that he's really talking about was the necessity of maintaining some form of equality. And so as they started paring down, remember, the Constitution possesses four types of enumerations. Actually, we could actually make a fifth, but we don't include the fifth. The first is roles. The second is responsibilities. The third are powers. The fourth is property. And the fifth is negative reservations. In other words, they can't do this. The states can't do this, or the federal government can't do this. And you'll find that in Article 1, Section 9, for the federal government can't do these things. And Article 1, Section 10, the state governments cannot do these things, which is why the 10th Amendment, you know, basically comes right out and says the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, which they're talking about Article 1, Section 10, those prohibitions placed upon the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. So in other words, if the role, responsibility, power, and property and or restrictions are not enumerated, then the federal government, you know, can't, well, included the restrictions. So the roles, responsibilities, powers, and property, if those things that are not enumerated, the federal government cannot meddle with it. When it comes to the states, if the states have been clearly restricted, like emitting bills of credit, or making anything other than gold and silver the tender for the payment of debt, legal payment of debt, then they can't do those things. But they can do anything else as long as it's not enumerated to the federal government, like healthcare, like energy. However, the states do not have general constitutions. This is the other thing you need to understand. Every state has an enumerated constitution, and I've yet to see a state where the people have actually delegated to the state to allow the state government to choose the form of government you are to use, where they can control the type of government or the type of energy you will use for your home to heat it, you know, for electricity, what have you. They don't, they're not there. Those powers are not enumerated. You're going to find the same thing regarding the environment. You're going to find the same thing regarding housing, labor. So how is it that they have all of these regulations? How is it that the state government has basically come down upon and regulated us to the nth degree? Because the federal government assumed it. They used money to get the states to do it. And then over time, they actually just started getting away with doing more and more nefarious things. And bottom line, the states are being used as our oppressors. Now, as we go on, Mr. Wilson's response basically said this. He could not admit that the doctrine that when the colonies became independent of Great Britain, they became independent also of each other. He read the Declaration of Independence, observing thereon that the United Colonies were declared to be free and independent states, and interfering that they were independent, not individually, but unitedly, and that they were confederated as they were independent states. Colonel Hamilton assented to the doctrine of Mr. Wilson. He denied the doctrine of the states were thrown into a state of nature. He was not prepared to admit that the doctrine of the Confederacy could be dissolved by partial infractions of it. He admitted that the states met now on an equal footing, but could see no inference. Now, this is interesting. We'll probably come back to this, because when he talks about inferences, you know, this is how Hamilton kind of has the shady side to him, because he'll tell you one thing and then he'll come right back around and say, well, you know, there is this inference. Anyway, we will be right back after this short promo. Thank you so much. If
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so I'm not sure how Madison was writing this, but it almost seems like there's a contradiction in here. Because Mr. Wilson, I'm going to reread this. Mr. Wilson could not admit the doctrine that when the colonies became independent of Great Britain, they became independent also of each other. He read the Declaration of Independence, observing thereon that the United Colonies were declared to be free and independent states. As a matter of fact, I'll go as far a little step further. If you read the Treaty of Versailles, or if you read that treaty with the King of Britain, he actually declared each of the states independent and free. And so he goes, and inferring that they were independent, not individually, but unitedly, and that they were confederated as they were independent states. So in other words, as they created these independent states, they created a confederation, and that was that's where they create very limited powers. Colonel Hamilton assented to the doctrine of Mr. Wilson. He denied the doctrine that the states were thrown into a state of nature. He was not yet prepared to admit the doctrine that the Confederacy could be dissolved by partial infractions of it. He admitted that the states met now on an equal footing, but could see no inference that from that against concerting a change of the system in this particular. He took this occasion of observing for the purpose of appeasing the fears of the small states, that two circumstances would render them secure under a national government, in which they might lose the equality of rank they now held. One was the local situation of the three large states, Virginia, Massachusetts, and Pennsylvania. They were separated from each other by distance of place, and equally so by all the peculiarities which distinguish the interests of one state of those from another. No combination, therefore, could be dreaded. In the second place, and you talk about a red herring. I have no idea why he even, you know, why that was even relevant to the small states. But anyway, in the second place, as there was a graduation in the states from Virginia, the largest down to Delaware, the smallest, it would always happen that ambitions, combinations among a few states might and would be counteracted by defenses, combinations of greater extent among the rest. No combination had been seen among large counties merely as such against lesser counties. The more close the union of the states and the more complete the authority of the whole, the less opportunity will be allowed the stronger states to injure the weaker. Now, and at this point, they adjourn for the day. So I have a real problem with this, because we clearly see today that the counties that are occupied by large metropolises, Los Angeles County, as a matter of fact, it was pointed out by Senator Lee just recently, that Los Angeles County having over 9 million people in it, actually had a greater population than almost all states except for, I think, four. New York, Florida, Texas, and I forget maybe the other one. Maybe have been four or five. But, I mean, think about that, folks. A county in California that has that size of a population. This is why you've heard me say several times that when your county gets that big or, you know, that populated, that's a large county, by the way. It's not necessarily huge, but it's a large county. Los Angeles County actually goes across the coastal, I'll say the coastal mountain range, because it extends up into Lancaster, which is in the high desert. If you're familiar with the terrain, it's a pretty good sized county. And due to the congestion in the freeway, it takes a while to drive that from one end of the county to another. Now, when it's the middle of the night, you know, you could probably get from one point to another within a couple of hours. But it is still a huge county. And there is merit in saying that some of these counties really do need to be, you know, shrunken down. That the county governments, you know, have these very specific responsibilities. What we see today, and what Hamilton is basically saying, is that the larger counties don't take advantage of the smaller ones. They do today. They clearly do today. As a matter of fact, there's many states where the small counties are paying for services that are only being rendered in the population centers, like, you know, public transportation and so forth. So anyway, as we go into the next day, Mr. Ellsworth stands up, and he's seconded by Mr. Gorham, moves to alter it to run that the government of the United States ought to consist of a supreme legislative, executive, and judiciary. This alteration, he said, would drop the word national and retain the proper title, the United States. And I want to be clear here, folks. How many times have you heard people tell you that the little U of United was the original intent in the Constitution? It wasn't. The little U United in the Declaration of Independence were that those states were little U United, but independent and sovereign. When they created this new federal government, they didn't create, you know, this all-encompassing government with all powers, but they did create a government that had enough power to actually maintain and serve the members of the union in very specific ways, and only in those ways, for national security purposes, not, you know, to be able to take their money and spend on whatever they want. Not to be able to assume or assert powers that weren't delegated. So anyway, he goes on and says, he could not admit the doctrine that a breach of any of the federal articles could dissolve the whole. Now, just keep in mind that I believe what was stated earlier regarding, and I believe it was Madison that said this, that a violation of the Articles of Confederation could clearly be dissolve the relationship of one state in that Articles of Confederation. It's the basic tenet of contract law. But what he's talking about is, I think they misunderstood Madison in thinking that he said that the entire Confederation would be dissolved if one state felt, hey, you know, this is a violation, we can't allow this to happen, and we're stepping out. That's what Madison was talking about, that every state had a right, if they felt that the character or the, you know, the violation was egregious enough, then they would have a right to basically nullify and remove themselves from the compact. And so this concept that they're talking about was, I think, more of not necessarily allowing a state to leave, dissolving the entire Confederation. And so he says, it would be highly dangerous not to consider the Confederation as still subsisting. He wished also the plan of the convention to go forth as an amendment to the Articles of Confederation, since under this idea, the authority of the legislatures could ratify it. If they were unwilling, the people will be so too. If the plan goes forth to the people for ratification, several succeeding conventions within the states would be unavoidable. He did not like these conventions. They were better fitted to pull down than to build up constitutions. Mr. Randolph did not object to the change of expression, but apprised the men who wished for it that he did not admit for the reasons assigned, particularly that of getting rid of a reference to the people for the ratification. The motion of Mr. Ellsworth was acquiesced without any contest. The second resolved that the national legislature ought to consist of two branches, taking up the word national struck out as of course. Mr. Lansing then stands up. Now, he's the one identified. There's other ones, but he's the one that was identified and was a solid anti-federalist even during the ratification debates. And so Mr. Lansing stands up and he basically goes back to the commission and he says, observe that the true question here was whether the convention would adhere to or depart from the foundation of the present Confederacy, and moved instead of the second resolution, quote, that the powers of legislation be vested in the United States in Congress. He had already assigned two reasons against such an innovation as was proposed. One, the want of competent powers in the convention, and two, the state of the public mind. It had been observed by Mr. Madison in discussing the first point that in two states, the delegates to Congress were chosen by the people, notwithstanding the first appearance of this remark. It had, in fact, no weight, as the delegates, however chosen, did not represent the people merely as so many individuals, but as forming a sovereign state. Mr. Randolph put it, he said, on its true footing, namely that the public safety superseded the scruple arising the review of our powers. Now, I'm going to stop right there. When we hear somebody say that the public safety arises above a person's scruple, do you see that today in your public servants, that they're concerned about your safety more so than their own bank account? Why is it that we have planes spraying us if our public servants were more concerned about our safety? Why is it that we're being bombarded with these heavy metals? And why is it we're being bombarded in our food and everything else with all of these atrocities, things that our body shouldn't be digesting, high fructose corn syrup and so forth? Are you really serious to think that this is a true paradigm? This may have been a character or a character quality of the time. But we have debased ourselves to a point where our government and our public servants don't care about public safety or our own lives. Anyway, going on, Mr. Lansing says, but in order to feel the force of this consideration, the same impression must be had of the public danger. He had not himself the same impression and could not therefore dismiss his scruple. Mr. Wilson contended that as the convention were only to recommend, they might recommend what they pleased. He differed much from him. Any act whatsoever so respectable a body must have a great effect, and if it does not succeed, will be a source of great dissension. He admitted that there was no certain criterion of public mind on the subject. He therefore recurred to the evidence of it given by the opposition in the states to the scheme of an impost. It could not be expected that those possessing sovereignty could ever voluntarily part with it. It was not to be expected from one state much less from 13. He proceeded to make some observations by the plan itself and arguments urged in support of it. The point of representation could receive no elucidation from the case of England. The corruption of the boroughs did not proceed from their comparative smallness, but from the actual fewness of the inhabitants. Some of them not having more than one or two, a great inequality existed in the counties of England. Yet the like complaint of peculiar corruption in the small ones has not been made. It had been said that Congress represent the state prejudices. Will not any other, whether chosen by the legislatures of the people, also represent the prejudices? It has been asserted by his colleague, Mr. Hamilton, because they're both from New York, that there was no coincidence of interest among the large states that ought to excite fears of oppression in the smaller. If it were true that such a uniformity of interest existed among the states, there was equal safety for all of them, whether the representation remained as hitherto or whether proportioned as now proposed. It is proposed that the general legislature shall have negative on the laws of the states. Is it conceivable that there will be leisure for such a task? There will, on the most moderate calculation, be as many acts sent up to the states as there are days in the year. In other words, he's basically foretelling that if they had the ability to start changing and controlling the states with legislation, that they would be doing it on a daily basis, if not more. And he's right. Will the members of the general legislature be competent judges? Will a gentleman from Georgia be a judge of the expedience of law, which is to operate in New Hampshire? Such a negative would be more injurious than that of Britain heretofore was. It is said that the national government must have the influence arising from the great offices of honors. In order to render such a government effectual, he believed such an influence to be necessary. But if the states will not agree to it, it is in vain. Worse than in vain to make the proposition. In this influence is to be attained, the states must entirely abolish. Will anyone say they would ever be agreed to? He doubted whether the general government equally beneficial to all can be attained. That now, under consideration, he is sure must utterly be unattainable. He had another objection. The system was too novel and complex. No man could foresee what its operation will be either with respect to the general government or the state governments. One or the other, it has to been surmised, must absorb the whole. In other words, the states must absorb, or the general government must absorb. He says one of the two has to basically rise to the top. And then we go through a few different comments for the day, Mr. Mason and Mr. Martin and Mr. Sherman and so forth. And then we jump down to Thursday the 21st. Now, after these kind of comments, as they went sideways with Mr. Lansing. And this is where they pick up with Dr. Johnson. And I don't know where he's from. I forget. But if you're interested, we have the documentation. Dr. Johnson, on a comparison of the two plans, which had been proposed from Virginia and New Jersey, it appeared that the peculiarity which characterized the latter, New Jersey, was its being calculated to preserve the individuality of the states. The plan for Virginia did not profess to destroy this individuality altogether, but was charged with such tendency. One gentleman alone, Colonel Hamilton, in his animadversions of the plan of New Jersey, boldly and decisively contended for an abolishment of the state governments. Mr. Wilson and the gentleman from Virginia, who also were adversaries of the New Jersey plan, held a different language. they wished to leave the states in possession of a considerable, though a subordinate, jurisdiction. They had not yet, however, shown how this could consist or be secured against. The general sovereignty and jurisdiction which they proposed to give the national government, if this would be shown in such a manner to satisfy the patrons of the New Jersey proposition that the individuality of states could not be endangered, many of their objections would no doubt be removed. In other words, we'd get on board with this if you could actually prove that there's a way to actually keep our jurisdiction and our sovereignty. If this could not be shown, their objections would have their full force. He wished it, therefore, to be well considered whether, in case the states, as was proposed, should retain some portion of sovereignty, at least this portion could be preserved without allowing them to participate effectually in the general government, without giving them each a distinction and equal vote for the purpose of defending themselves in the general councils. Now, Mr. Wilson's going to get up. But if you really think about what he's talking about, what they're seeking, it's, to me, it seems like the real differentiation comes into the form of the Constitution. I believe the men in this room really believe that powers were to be general, that the federal government under this concept would be able to creep into doing all sorts of things. And I don't think that they really nailed down, because nobody has talked about defined and limited roles, responsibilities, powers, or these enumerations that clearly limit this government. I mean, they're basically saying, well, you're going to have these governments, and this is going to be a government that's going to swallow up this one, or that one's going to swallow up that one, based on some energies, because there's no stopping it, because they all possess these general powers. At the time, the states had general powers. They did not have really well-defined and enumerated constitutions. As a matter of fact, these new formed constitutions were really evolving, and they were evolving at a breakneck speed because of this convention. In other words, this new paradigm of a limited power of attorney becoming a constitution was never really thought of before. This is a game changer. This constitutional convention and what these men were inspired to do was truly a game changer. Now, Mr. Wilson stands up and says, out of respect for Dr. Johnson, added the importance of the subject led him to attempt, unprepared as he was, to solve the difficulty which had been started. It was asked how the general government and individuality of particular states could be reconciled to each other, and how the latter could be secured against the former. Might it not, on the other side, be asked how the former is to be secured against the latter? In other words, can the states be secured against the federal government, or now he proposes, can the federal government be secured from the states? Might it not, on the other side, be asked how the former is to be secured against the latter? It was generally admitted that a jealousy and rivalship would be felt between the general and particular governments. I am going to tell you that that probably persisted for a while, but once people realized the beautiful thing of coining and minting money and having money in your pockets, started changing things. And the day they were capable of actually moving from coin and precious metals to paper representative of metals, and then eventually paper without any representation whatsoever, it became an unlimited opportunity of the federal government to be able to lure with their lucre the controls over states and their people. Now, Mr. Wilson goes on and says, as the plan now stood, though indeed contrary to his opinion, one branch of the general government, the Senate, or the second branch, was to be appointed by the state legislatures. The state legislatures, therefore, by this participation in the general government, would have an opportunity to defend their rights. Ought not a reciprocal opportunity be given to the general government of defending itself by having an appointment of someone constituent branch of this of the state governments? If a security be necessary on one side, it would seem reasonable to demand it on the other. But taking the matter in more general view, he saw no danger to the states from the general government. In case a combination could be made by the large ones, it would produce a general alarm amongst the rest, and the project would be frustrated, but there was no temptation to such a project. The states having a general in a having in general a similar interest in case of proposition, the national legislature to encroach on the state legislature, he conceived a general alarm would take place in the national legislature itself, that it would communicate itself to the state legislatures and would finally spread among the people at large. The general government would be as ready to preserve the rights of the states as the latter to preserve the rights of the individuals, all to the members of the former having a common interest as representatives of all the people of the latter to leave the state governments in possession of what people wish them to retain. He could not discover, therefore, any danger whatever on the side from which it had been apprehended. On the contrary, he conceived that in spite of every precaution, the general government would be in perpetual danger of encroachments from the state governments. Now, obviously, they haven't even really designed these limitations and everything else, but I'm here to tell you, folks, when you really look at the what they're talking about, the rights of the people were basically managed atrociously by the states. I mean, the states were the bad actors and have been. And even under Trump, it was the states that were the bad actors. I mean, as soon as Biden got in, I mean, many of the states started pushing back. But look at Wyoming and how they jumped on the bandwagon of shutting down and basically putting the heel of tyranny on the necks of their citizens. That was Governor Jordan, Governor Gordon, a Republican in that state. And I'm telling you, he's as good as a Democrat. As a matter of fact, when we look at Governor Noem, it was the same thing. Governor Noem may seem like a really good conservative or, you know, somebody that's no, she's not constitutional at all. She builds up and lives behind bureaucracies. She uses bureaucratic government and those types of regulations to actually invoke, you know, what she wants to do instead of actually allowing the legislative body to legislate. Folks, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. We'll be back tomorrow with more of these post-Hamilton plan comments. Thank you so much. Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.